Welcome to Obesity, a Disease, the official Obesity Medicine Association podcast exploring the many facets of the disease of obesity. In this episode, OMA Chief Science Officer Dr. Harold Bays interviews Angela Fitch, MD. Dr. Fitch is the president-elect of the OMA and co-director of the MGH Weight Center at Massachusetts General Hospital. In this series of podcasts, our experts discuss select articles from the latest version of Obesity Pillars, an open-access, online-only journal published by the OMA, committed to providing evidence-based research for healthcare clinicians in the field of obesity medicine. Today's featured article is entitled Obesity: Definition, Diagnosis, Bias, Standard Operating Procedures, and Telehealth. Obesity, a Disease podcast is brought to you by the Obesity Medicine Association, a clinical leader in obesity medicine.
Welcome. My name is Dr. Harold Bays, Medical Director and President of the Louisville Metabolic and Atherosclerosis Research Center located in Louisville, Kentucky. I'm also Chief Science Officer of the Obesity Medicine Association and editor of Obesity Pillars, which we're going to talk about here in a minute. We are fortunate today to have with us Dr. Angela Fitch. Angela, why don't you tell the folks who you are and what you do?
Harold, thank you so much for having me. I'm Dr. Angela Fitch. I am the president-elect of the Obesity Medicine Association, and I am the co-director of the Massachusetts General Hospital Weight Center in Boston, Massachusetts. Half of my time is spent clinically seeing patients with obesity. The other half of my time is spent as the co-director of the Weight Center. We have a multidisciplinary weight center, surgeons, psychologists, dietitians, health coaches, vast array of psychologists and other staff members that help us to care for people with obesity throughout their entire lifespan, from pediatrics to adulthood. Thank you for having me today.
Yeah, look, I think it's great that you just have such a wealth of clinical experience. But the other thing that maybe most people know, but maybe not everybody knows, is you were first author of one of the clinical practice statements from the Obesity Medicine Association, published in Obesity Pillars recently this year. And it was entitled Obesity Definition, Diagnosis, Bias, Standard Operating Procedures, and Telehealth. So that was just like a lot of stuff you had kind of crammed into this publication. And one of the things that I was struck is that right at the beginning of this article was this definition that, as you know, we drafted many, many years ago, where obesity is defined as a chronic, progressive, relapsing, and treatable, multifactorial, neurobehavioral disease, wherein an increase in body fat promotes adipose tissue dysfunction and abnormal fat mass physical forces, resulting in adverse metabolic, biomechanical, and psychosocial health consequences. So I feel like that's a very good definition. It took us years to come up with it, but I think it just really crystallizes why obesity is a disease from a pathophysiological standpoint. But I guess for the folks out there, why do you think it was important that we establish from the very beginning, starting with that preamble to your publication, why did you feel it was so important to define obesity as a disease?
Well, Harold, as you know, that's the title of our podcast, right? Obesity, a Disease. And I think it's so important because obesity for so long has been thought of as a moral character flaw, as the ability to just not have enough willpower, you know, to control one's lifestyle. I mean, we now know so much more about adiposity, right? That it's really about the adipose tissue and the biological interactions between the brain, the gut, the adipose tissue, the pancreas, you know, this whole complicated obesity disease process. And it's so important for the world and for patients and for medical providers, for everyone, you know, to really accept this as a disease and treat it as a disease, for the disease to actually, you know, be treated. Because for so long, it just has been undertreated because of its lack of recognition.
I'm hearing some undertones here. What I'm hearing from you is that underrecognized, underappreciated, not characterized as a disease and such. And I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think what I'm hearing is that in the past and even today, might be some bias against patients with obesity. Would I be correct in making that assumption?
Very much so. And that's why we included bias in this clinical practice statement, because it does go along with the fact that even though the American Medical Association declared obesity a disease in the not so far past, right, in 2013, which, you know, we've known it's been a disease for quite longer than that. And still, even people themselves, I talked to a patient on the phone yesterday that called me about a side effect of her medication. And she's like, you know, she went back to several times, you know, I just feel like this is my fault that I have obesity, that, you know, I shouldn't have to take medication for obesity. And, you know, nobody likes to take medication. No one wants to have a disease in the first place. But we have to recognize that there are treatable ways to make things better, right? To accomplish what we're trying to accomplish, which is to make disease go away. That's what medicine is. And that's why we exist. And there are multiple ways of doing that today in all diseases, right? There's surgery, there's chemotherapy and or pharmacotherapy, we would call it in obesity. And then there's lifestyle factors. And all of those things have to come together and play a role. But we have to get away from this bias and stigmatized nature of the fact that it's just all about eat less and exercise more. And if you can't do that, it's your fault.
Well, why don't you give the folks some practical guidance, because I know you did that in the article. Let's say, for example, you're a clinician, you got a medical practice, whether or not it's a obesity medicine practice or not, it's really not relevant. I mean, the fact is, most people who see patients are going to see patients with the overweight and the obesity. So let's just take, say, for example, the waiting room. What are just some basic, simple things that folks can do, clinicians can do in their medical practices to alleviate this bias and alleviate the uncomfortableness that many of our patients have with obesity just right there in the waiting room? What can people do?
Exactly. And that's what we cover in this article in Obesity Pillars, is the fact that having larger chairs, larger size chairs, you could have a bench, you know, so it's not so, you know, feeling like I'm sitting in a large chair, you know, right? So a longer bench where people can feel comfortable sitting. Things without arms. So having chairs without arms so that, you know, people aren't having to squeeze into something that is much smaller for their frame. You know, making it a welcoming place where you can also, you know, having larger size gowns, having a scale, things that are very basic, like having a scale that people can actually stand on and can actually weigh them, you know, that doesn't show them that their weight is sort of over the limit of the scale, which is extremely embarrassing for a lot of people. And also having, you know, larger size gowns and blood pressure cuffs that are appropriately fitting for people of larger size arms. I've seen so many times, you know, someone put a blood pressure cuff on somebody and it pop off because their arm is too large for the cuff. So these are basic things that we can do both in the waiting room and our office to make sure people with obesity aren't feeling as if they're being isolated in any way or shape or form and having, you know, bias or stigma against them.
And I think one of the real benefits of this article for which you were first author is this inclusion of standard operating procedure template, where you have just recommendations that people are going to see patients with the obesity, or especially if they're going to establish a obesity medicine practice, that it has these tables, this litany of tables of standard operating procedures and essential equipment. So, you know, you just gave one just very small example of the types of things that clinicians can do to be more welcoming and to provide better and higher quality care to patients. But my goodness, this article has, like I said, just multiple tables of things that clinicians should consider as far as the standard operating procedures. Can you give a sense about what's included there and why did you think that was important?
Yes, I get asked so often. I've been, I was a primary care physician, internal medicine and pediatrics, for about 10 years before I focused my treatment on obesity specifically. In focusing my treatment on obesity, I was always in multidisciplinary practice, you know, where I was fortunate to sort of walk into a practice in the beginning. So I had all of that sort of set up for me, but then I was able to learn that. And then it was the sort of see one, do one, teach one sort of method. Then I went and I built one from scratch. And now I'm here at Mass General. We have one of the oldest multidisciplinary weight centers in the country. It was created 20 years ago by one of our founding fathers, Dr. Lee Kaplan. And, you know, his vision of having this multidisciplinary center. And so people ask me all the time, I get so many questions about how do I build a center, or how do I build a place where treating obesity is efficient and caring and open and non-stigmatizing. And so I think, you know, having all this information in one location can be very helpful for people who are looking to do it, because you really do just have to sort of do it. People, I think, are always wanting to know all the ins and outs, which is why that's here in this one spot, you know, for people to be able to understand what kind of equipment they need, what kind of electronic medical record, other resources they might need, you know, in order to start a practice. With 42% of the population struggling with the disease of obesity, and that's expected to grow even further. Those were pre-pandemic numbers. You know, there's a lot of people with obesity that need help. And so just being welcoming to those patients and making sure that every practice, whether it's cardiology practice or primary care practice or obesity practice, is set up to serve people is what this is trying to outline.
I think one thing to make clear to folks, I mean, we're not actually, this article doesn't actually provide standard operating procedures, okay? And what it does is it provides templates. And so this can be... This is intended to just give the headings for people to then just add in their what's applicable to their own individual practices. So you just talked about how there are a lot of multiple disciplinary obesity practices out there and such, and that's true and that's great. And there's going to be a lot of similarities, but there's going to be a lot of differences too. So just by providing the headings of all these different aspects of how to run an obesity medicine practice, boy, I think that's just such a resource and a great start. And the other thing I would just say is, because we haven't said it thus far, this article's free. It doesn't even cost you anything, right? I mean, you took the time to put all these things together and put it all in a single place, just like you said, and it's free to everybody. Because we're just here to try to help patients, right? Here to help the clinicians, help the patient. The other thing I guess I would like to talk a little bit about is this, and you and I have had this conversation before, how it is that we have just leapfrogged over what probably would have happened in a few decades anyway, but we are full scale into telehealth now. I think it would eventually got to where we are, just because I think that's where the technology was leading and such, but we're smack in it right now. And to the people that are practicing telehealth that would like to know how you adapt that to obesity medicine, we actually have an acronym, you know, the ADAPT method, where it's assessment, diagnosis, advice, prognosis, and treatment. And Angela, you may recall that I think it was on a Sunday, I called you on the phone. I said, we're putting together this thing on telehealth, and we wrote down the basics, and the names all just came to this acronym ADAPT. It was like the creepiest thing. I said, this is unbelievable. What does it mean when you apply the ADAPT method to management patients with obesity, and how effective can you really be in managing patients with obesity via telehealth?
If there's one good thing that can come out of the pandemic, I'm hopeful that it's that the access to telemedicine services, the coverage of telemedicine services, you know, continues to be applied. Because telemedicine, especially obesity care, is very treatable via telemedicine, right? Because a lot of what we do is medication management, is vital sign capture, data capture, you know, data capture from the patient, you know, their side effects or how they're feeling and what they're doing. The lifestyle management piece of it, you know, is all very deliverable via apps, via technology supported, human supported with technology to be able to deliver, you know, that weekly accountability or that weekly check-in with somebody, even daily check-in for some patients that might need that in the future, right? So this is really going to move forward in medicine altogether, but especially in obesity care, because it is something we can deliver. And my hope and vision for the future is that people have access to the scales, blood pressure cuffs, things that are connected so that data can just be, you know, transmitted and we can just see patients. Our patients have been very grateful for telemedicine. You know, we converted to 100% telemedicine when the pandemic started very quickly. I mean, we were already all set up, fortunately, in our clinic. We were already delivering telemedicine in a small piece, like you said. So it was already something we were doing, but it was just a smaller piece of, you know, people had, there were just patients that had sort of early adopters that had, you know, gravitated towards that type of care. But then immediately when the pandemic hit, we were able to go 100% virtual. We actually increased our access for patients, meaning we increased our office visits by 30% in that first year because people were not no-showing. People were able to show up better. You know, it's not like they're not showing up on purpose, but, you know, things come up in your workday and you all of a sudden have a meeting and you can't make it to the doctor, so you have to cancel your appointment, where, you know, now people can just zoom in quick and take that, you know, 15 minutes for that follow-up visit. So it's really revolutionized our care, and our hope is that we put this together in this adapt model just to show people how you can adapt it, right? How you can change what you were normally doing, you know, checking your blood pressure in the office or checking your weight in the office, how you can adapt that for home and some of the technology that can be utilized, especially in the care of obesity.
Well, let's just get really granular here, because I don't know, there may be some folks listening that maybe haven't done telehealth, maybe a little dubious, maybe a little unsure about exactly what can be accomplished in a telehealth visit. Let's start with assessment. Let's just start with the basics. At the University of Louisville, a lot of the telehealth that is done by telephone, but a lot of other people do it via video and such. When you're assessing a patient, do you do it through just the telephone alone or do it through video?
We do it via video, but that's because we're also very, very thankfully our technology is set up that way in our EMR. And I think a lot of people today, especially with Doximity being a very accessible app for clinicians, you know, they came out very quickly and they were already an established platform, but they really rolled themselves and innovated themselves very quickly, you know, so that people can access that. And it just texts a link to the patient. They just click on that link and they're connected, right? So I think kind of like a HIPAA-compliant FaceTime, so to speak, you know, because some of the other sort of modalities that you use for video are not HIPAA-compliant. So having that compliant technology platform is very nice. And there are others, certainly. There are lots of them today. So thankfully, I think a lot of that innovation happened very quickly because of the pandemic.
And when we talk about, in addition to the history that I think you just spoke about, there's a lot of the physical exam that you can be done by video. Am I right about that?
Exactly, right? And so we just talk about, too, how you can even just comment, you know, on people's mental status, on their mood, you know, just by seeing them, right? How they're, you know, how they might be breathing even, right? You can tell if someone is short of breath, even on the phone, right? If I'm talking in very short sentences, you know, and I can barely get my words out, you can tell that I'm really, you know, struggling with shortness of breath, for example. And so you can really, you know, get a handle on that with either, you know, telephonic care, voice-only care, or virtual sort of full-service video with doing that assessment. And nowadays, too, there's so many opportunities for connected devices to really, you know, sort of connect, or patients will send pictures in the EMR. They will send me snapshots from their body composition scale. They'll send me snapshots from their Apple Watch on their pulse or their actual rhythm strip, you know, because some of the technology nowadays, you know, collects that information, even if it's not directly connected to your EMR, so you're getting the information real time. You know, patients can send you these snapshots, certainly, as other opportunities.
And when you talk about snapshots and such, I mean, I've even heard some people that do the video help that they'll have the patient like go to their cabinets, you know, videotape their like where their food is located, and say, you know, let's look what you got in your cabinets or what's in your refrigerator, and try to get that kind of real practical that you can't do in the office. Right? You could only do
no, video. Right. And we've had such a great uptake of some of our group programs, because now our groups are done via video. And I think, again, it's just easier for people to sort of, you know, connect in on whatever platform's being used, you know, from a video standpoint. And the dietitians lead cooking classes via video now. The dietitians love the fact that, again, like you said, patients are showing them, you know, here's what I'm eating for a snack, you know, and they show the food label. You can, like, just, you know, give that feedback, you know, very, very real time, which I think is a huge advantage, especially in our treatment space, you know, in the type of lifestyle intervention and the level of accountability that, you know, we need that accountability as humans to change any behavior. I tell patients that all the time, right? Like Olympic swimmers or ice skaters or whoever, you know, snowboarders, right? They have coaches. And most Olympic athletes, right, are better than their coaches at their sport. But the coaches are there to coach them, right? To tell help them be accountable and to help them do, help them change something, right? To become, to notice things and then to evolve on that change. And the idea is we're constantly just trying to improve ourselves all the time. And if we work towards that, you know, we need that support and that encouragement. And using telemedicine is, or any kind of connected technology is hugely easier than sort of, you know, coming in, driving in, parking, paying for parking, coming up to an exam room. It's just so much quicker to be able to do that via telemedicine. It's a great evolution over time.
Yeah, I want to go back to what you're talking about, accountability. I think some people get that confused. You know, there's a big difference between blame and accountability. And that's where I think sometimes a lot of clinicians get that, they get tripped up. Okay, so no one is suggesting that that when a patient comes in, that the focus should be on blaming the patient, right? I think that's what you said at the very beginning. At the same time, it is a basic component of most any behavior modification that I know of, that there are going to be certain metrics that you're going to follow, and that's accountability. So what's the difference between blame and accountability? I see them as two totally different things, but I'm not sure everybody else does.
I would agree. And I think a lot of times patients also don't see them as two separate things, right? Patients, we all have a lot of internal self-blame. I read a very interesting article recently about this idea of behavior. And you know, when we're judging somebody else or we're looking at somebody else and we look at their actions, their behaviors, right? But internally, we see our behavior differently because we know the intent behind our behavior. And so all of this is about being accountable in a positive manner.
That's right.
Right? Not to be negatively accountable.
It's, you know, some people get motivated by if things don't go quite as well as they should. But no matter whether it's positive or negative, it's got to be productive. And blame is counterproductive.
Exactly. You have to measure something to change it, right? I mean, to want to change it, you have to measure it. And it doesn't mean that even if it goes the wrong way, I tell this to patients all the time, because, you know, there's this sort of, you know, unfortunate love-hate relationship with the scale. And especially when we're dealing with, you know, our weight and weight management. I mean, you know, there's lots of people say, you know, scale is just a number. The scale is just gravity. It's not really defining you, which is completely and utterly true. We should never define ourselves by any kind of numbers, right? We should drive to be happy and to be satisfied, you know, to live a full and content life as much as we can. And this is not about sort of, you know, micromanaging every single bite we put in our mouth or anything else, because again, it gets back to this bias and stigma around the disease of obesity, right? We don't do that with other diseases. And there are lots of lifestyle components to other diseases too, heart disease, cancer. They all have lifestyle components that when we follow a more healthful lifestyle, those things get better or perform better. We perform better as the human body. But we can never be perfect and in our lifestyle. And we just strive to sort of try to improve it as much as possible, to live happily as possible, and to live full and content lives as possible. But in the process, try to be live as good of quality of life as possible as well. And that's what we're trying to do, is to find ways for people to do this, but ways for people to also be successful with a goal they might have as it relates to the disease process of obesity, not just about their weight or a number on the scale. And that's what we try to, you know, to get across, is this is about a disease process. And we have ways of helping make disease processes better. And that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, I find I have like this cognitive dissonance. I try to engage in physical activity, physical exercise every single day. But I must say, I usually put on about 2 or 3 pounds over the winter. You know, I always say scales are more accurate during the summer. That's what I tell myself, you know, somehow I convince myself. But anyway, we've talked about assessment for the ADAPT and the diagnosis. So we can certainly do a lot of that over the telehealth. And included in that diagnosis are things like the scales and the watches. I think you agree that going forward, we're probably going to have more and more connectivity between people's individual wearables and such, or like I said, scales and such, that are just going to be integrated into the clinician's office. We don't have that now for a lot of places, but you say people take a snapshot of it and send it to you. And that's, I think that's just fine. Which brings us to the next thing is, how effective do you believe it is? And so this would be the advice part of ADAPT. How effective do you think advice is with regard to telehealth?
I think it's very effective because we have so many ways of delivering different types of electronic, you know, again, just giving advice this way, right, in a speaking mode, but sending patients things, sending them links, you know, to look at, sending them different websites, different videos that can be accessed. We use a platform that helps, you know, connect our patients to us, and then that we can deliver educational content that way. We can push it each week, you know, push different content to the patients each week. And then, you know, working with a platform like that, that increases engagement. You know, how much do we engage with something as humans, right? How much do we decide to click on it and read it? And how short does that have to be? How long does that have to be, et cetera? So that's the future is going to be trying to, again, figure out how best to deliver this advice in a timely manner that's digestible and is actionable at the same time, while it's not blaming and stigmatizing and feeling like something negative.
And then the P portion of ADAPT is prognosis. And hopefully the listeners have gotten a sense. I mean, look at all this wealth of information you can get with regard to assessment, and the wealth of information that with, again, wearable technologies, home technologies and such, that we can get with regard to diagnosis. And then the ability to electronically give people links and such and education, and like we talked about, videotape their cabinets and all that kind of stuff to give them practical home advice that's going to make a difference. I don't think it's any surprise that the ability to more accurately give a prognosis, to give a sense about how patients are doing in some ways, if you're talking to people where they live, I mean, it's at least got to be as good as being in the office, don't you think?
Yes, and I think it increases access too, right? With 5,000 or so people specialized in obesity treatment in the country and others, you know, you don't have to be specialized to treat it, right? For sure. But the idea of, you know, being able to access someone is a huge problem in our country. You know, accessing providers, right? Clinicians, you know, and primary care. We have these issues with access. So being able to get that from far away, right? We have several of our patients that come from multiple states around the New England area. And so they can easily, you know, see us much easier than driving all the way, you know, down to Boston and dealing with Boston traffic. So I do think, you know,
that's practical.
Having this.
Boston, just Boston, you know, pretty much any city.
That's what the P should stand for.
Traffic
practical.
Is a huge deterrent to people getting medical care, isn't it? It sounds kind of silly, but it's not silly.
Well, and especially some of our patients that have severe obesity, who we've also seen an increase in access of people that really have serious troubles, you know, transporting due to, again, mobility problems. And it's a real struggle for people sometimes, you know, that have to arrange for transportation, that have to come by an ambulance because of their size and not being able to, you know, even ride easily in a family member's car. And so it really has been a great ability, you know, to help people from all areas and all types of patient. And again, as we mentioned before, there's a lot of stigma, unfortunately. And that's what we're trying to, you know, work hard at the Obesity Medicine Association and several others, the Obesity Action Coalition, you know, everyone is trying to work hard to get rid of this bias and stigma, because people also just feel stigmatized, you know, coming to the office, right? When it also is not set up for them, you know, so making sure that the exam table can hold their weight and things like that, you know, are things that sometimes we don't think as clearly about.
Yeah. So it comes down to this, and I think this may be the question that maybe there's patients that are listening to this, a lot of people with obesity listening to this, maybe a lot of clinicians are listening to this, and they're like, okay, well, this is all great. I understand this ADAPT model. I can see how you can assess patients. I can see how you can diagnose them with the technologies we have now. I could see how giving advice may be even better if it's in a home base than if they just come to the office. And the ability to determine how people are doing on a prognostic standpoint, I get all that. But how on earth can you treat somebody through telehealth? I mean, how do people get, let's just say they want to get dietary guidance, or how is it if you want to prescribe a drug, or how is it that if you think they need bariatric surgery, how do you implement treatment via telehealth?
Well, and it really is doable, right? Because, I mean, we can talk about the different treatment options. We can, you know, present the data around outcomes, right, and align those outcomes with the treatment options. I think that's the biggest thing that we need to do in a shared decision-making way with the patients, right, to sort of acknowledge the disease process and then provide treatment that is going to get them to the goals that they want, right? Do they need 10% weight loss? Do they need 15% weight loss? Do they need 20% weight loss because they want their diabetes to go away? We have data now that shows that if you want your diabetes to be in remission, you need greater than 20% sustained weight loss, 15 to 20% in that range. And you have to sustain that. And we know that that's biologically extremely challenging to do. And so we know that there are treatments that are better than some other treatments. You know, there's a hierarchy, so to speak, of treatments that are going to provide a more consistent result. And so, you know, reviewing these risks, benefits, we do a surgery school now via Zoom, you know, via a group visit so that the nurse practitioner goes over the different types of surgeries that are available. So the patients are more knowledgeable of the surgeries. We used to have that as an in-person thing, and it would get, you know, variable attendance, and it would get variable attention for the patients because, you know, by the time you drive in and you get the stress of parking and driving, you're so stressed out, you're not really able to pay attention because you're like so stressed and your adrenaline's going so high that it's just something that's more, I think, easier for them to take in, you know, when they're sitting in the comfort of their home or their office. So I think there's a lot of treatment that can be done. Now, we can't do surgery yet via telehealth, although with robotic surgery nowadays, I'm sure it's essentially going to be a way. But we actually, our surgeons have been seeing patients via telemedicine, and then the patients will go through the entire process via telemedicine. And the first time they actually physically meet with the surgeon, person to person, is in the pre-op, the staging area, you know, in anesthesia. And that can have some limitations, right? If you, for example, you know, we can't feel your thyroid, you know, when we're on telemedicine. We can't tell if it's enlarged, or we can't tell if you have, from a surgery standpoint, if there's something that's discreetly wrong with
like valvular heart disease with a big murmur or something like that.
Yeah. With a big murmur, exactly. Although I think that's going to get better because we have these stethoscopes now that transmit, right? Or that they're acoustic stethoscopes, right? So there's no reason why that couldn't be something a patient had at home, right? In a little kit, right? With their pulse ox and their stethoscope, they just put it on their chest along with their blood pressure cuff and it transmits. So I think those things are going to be a lot better. So there's that rare occasion where someone might have something that would, you know, that we didn't catch by history, or someone else didn't catch by physical already, because, you know, we have all this data now in the EMR too, which also aids us in making decisions and on treatment, you know, because we have a lot of data that even from outside hospitals that is just available to us, you know, to see that they had a CT scan for something else, you know, a year ago. So we know sort of, you know, other more things about that patient than we did before. So I think the treatment is very doable.
Yeah. Look, it isn't like that doesn't happen now though. I mean, for patients who were seen by the surgeon and who were previously seen by their primary care, it's not unusual on the day of surgery that somebody finds something else and the surgery is postponed or things. So that's not really,
exactly. You
know, and in our research facility here, I mean, we have patients seen, we have all this blood work done, we do a thorough history, and I can't tell you how many times when it comes down to determining eligibility to get into a clinical trial, at the last minute, we find something. So that's going to happen regardless. I guess the totality of what I'm gathering from all this is this, as I said, I think this was going to happen 2 or 3 decades from now anyway. It's just that COVID-19 just pushed this, you know, this accelerated this. And now I think that this is, for a lot of patients, it's just a much better place where they can get that, like you said, that dietitian that can give them that one-on-one counseling while they're at home. They could get that education about what potential surgical options may be available. You can call in a prescription, for goodness sake, right? Like, when's the last time you wrote a prescription that they had, that the patient had to take from your hand physically? These are things that they're resolved. So the treatment side of it is every bit an advancement as all the other four aspects that we talked about that. Would you agree?
Yes. One of the key things, though, to understand about obesity medicine treatment is that some of our medications are controlled substances. And so there are specific laws around controlled substances and the prescribing of controlled substances via telemedicine. Rightfully so, because, you know, that started with people, you know, getting narcotics, so to speak, you know, via the internet. And so, you know, we don't want that then, you know, was a worrisome, you know, during our narcotic epidemic, right? Our drug use epidemic. And so because of some of those restrictions, it unfortunately restricts some of our our treatments as well to having to have an in-person face-to-face visit initially, at least, to be able to prescribe those types of medication. Those restrictions were waived during the pandemic, but I think that those restrictions will be reinstilled once the pandemic, quote unquote, you know, the public health emergency is lifted. So it is something to keep abreast of, especially in those medication classes. So there are other medication classes that we have, obviously, that are not controlled substances. So that does allow for a lot of prescribing of those types of medications. And then in that other category, one would have to be seen in person at least once, but then other follow-up can be done via telemedicine, depending on state law, as well as the national laws in place for now.
Angela, thank you so much for this. We covered so much. And again, for clinicians that are interested, I'd encourage you to, you know, just go to Obesity Pillars website. It's Dr. Angela Fitch, first author of this clinical practice statement from the Obesity Medicine Association, talking about obesity definition, bias, standard operating procedures, and telehealth. I think it's a fabulous resource. And Angela, I just, you know, again, just really want to thank you for being on this podcast today. Do you have any closing remarks?
No, Harold, just that I hope one day we'll have a future that's free of obesity bias and where everybody can get the access to the care that they need.
Well, that's a good way to end it. Thank you very much. Again, my name is Dr. Harold Bays, and you've been listening to Obesity, a Disease.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Obesity, a Disease. For more information about obesity medicine podcasts and other valuable resources from the clinical leaders in obesity medicine, please visit www.obesitymedicine.org/podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode and want to listen regularly, head over to iTunes where you can subscribe, rate, and leave us a much appreciated review. The views expressed in this episode are those of the host and guest and do not necessarily represent the opinions, beliefs, or policies of the Obesity Medicine Association or its members. Please join us again for our next episode of Obesity, a Disease.